It would seem that a key to winning the war on terror would be to prevent the resurgence of the Taliban and al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And yet, just a couple of days ago, Admiral Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, testified that Washington's first priority is, quote, rightly and firmly in Iraq, whereas in Afghanistan, we do what we can. Where does that leave the 25,000 American troops currently in Afghanistan? Well, with me now for the second part of today's Underreported are Sebastian Younger and photographer Tim Hetherington. They joined an American platoon in Afghanistan's Korangal Valley, and they've collaborated on an article and photo spread for the January issue of Vanity Fair. I'm pleased to welcome them to the show. Hello.
Hi.
When were you in Afghanistan?
We've been there several times, part of a year-long project to follow one platoon throughout their whole deployment. So I was there in June, right when they first deployed. This is Battle Company deploying into the Korangal Valley in eastern Afghanistan. Tim and I went back in September. I ripped my Achilles tendon when I was there, so I had to recover for a few months.
And now Tim is on crutches.
And that,
is this a dangerous thing for your life?
Well,
we
keep handing off injuries. Yeah, he went back in October and broke his leg, and now I'm going back in January.
So is Afghanistan bad for legs? And
journalist legs, yeah. I think so.
How big is the second platoon that you stayed with?
Platoons are around 30 men, and there's four platoons in a company, so roughly around 150 men or so in the Korangal Valley.
And very young. You say that a 27-year-old in the platoon was considered the old man of the group.
I mean, soldiers are always young, 19, 20, 21 years old. So 27 is pretty advanced age. I don't know what they think of me at 45.
Did they have a specific mission when you were with them?
I suppose the mission was just basically to slowly edge up the valley. But there'd been a lot of the land is hotly contested by both Taliban and al-Qaeda foreign fighters. And we were particularly with one group, 2nd Platoon, and they were holding an outpost called Restrepo, named after a medic of the platoon who was killed a couple of months ago. And basically it's a small position on the side of a mountain. It's totally exposed, and they try to hold that position and therefore, like a chess game, kind of draw fire off the main base.
Have they suffered many casualties?
They're running a casualty rate at about 20%.
That's wow.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, on the operation that I was on when I broke my leg, we had, I think, 3 dead and 6 wounded in about 6-7 days.
Eight wounded,
yeah.
Well, you say in the middle of the article, if there was one thing the battle company knew how to do, it was fight. So are these guys still there?
Oh, yes. Yes, they're there till next September.
What's the Korangal Valley like? Where in Afghanistan is it?
I was really surprised when I saw it. It's in eastern Afghanistan in Kunar province. Many experiences in Afghanistan have always involved sort of more arid, desert-like environments. This looks like Colorado. Very, very steep mountains and big timber on the ridgelines. I mean, big, huge cedar trees that are actually felled and are part of a very lucrative timber trade in the area.
So because it's in the east, is it abut Pakistan?
It's about the Korangal is about 20 miles from Pakistan, so a lot of ammunition and weapons and foreign fighters come across on these mule trails from Pakistan into the Korangal Valley. It's part of something called the Nuristan-Kunar corridor that the Afghans used when they were fighting the Soviets to move supplies into the doorsteps of Kabul.
Does it present any problems for a photographer, the way this place looks?
No, not at all. In fact, no. It's like it's pretty straightforward in that way. I think the hardest thing about it is that working there is extremely physical. Like on the cave. I mean, it's very steep mountainsides. When you're on a patrol or if you're on a combat operation, you're carrying your 3 liters of water, food for 2 days, warm mountain gear. So you're carrying it. I'm carrying a pack of, say, and bulletproof vest,
And then all your photo
gear. And all your kit. So you're probably carrying, like, between 60 pounds and upwards. I mean, the soldiers carry between 110 to 150 pounds, depending on their weaponry. So, I mean, it's a really physically difficult environment.
And I'd assume dangerous as well if there is a 20% attrition rate, where a bullet can hit a photographer or a journalist just as easily as it can hit a soldier.
Yes, we were. I was in June. I was ambushed. We were ambushed very, very intensely. bullets hitting were hitting a wall that we were crouched behind. And then at Outpost Restrepo, we were getting the unit was getting into firefights two or three times a day.
Weren't there rumors that Osama bin Laden was hiding there at some point?
I've read some things about Osama bin Laden in the area, but it's there are reports of his whereabouts in many, many places. It's hard to tell.
Most people think he's in Pakistan.
The guess from everybody said is he's in Pakistan. But what's interesting about the Corongal Valley is in 2005, it was the scene where a SEAL team was trapped up there, and the foreign fighters and local Taliban killed 3 out of 4 of them, and then a helicopter that went in to rescue the remaining soldier was shot down, and all 16 on board were killed. And what was interesting, during this time, there was an Egyptian called Abu Iklis that used to run the operation in the Corongal Valley. And I think the significant thing is that a lot of people, when they think of Afghanistan, seem to lump both these groups into one. And in fact, the ISAF, the coalition forces, also call them ACM, Anti-Coalition Militia. But in fact, they're really two sort of separate entities. On the one hand, you have local Afghani or Korangali troops, the Taliban, and then you have the foreign fighters, Al-Qaeda-backed, also other militia backed by, Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or Wahhabi sects. And that these two groups, sometimes they come together and sometimes they don't. So Abu Iklis is Egyptian. Obviously, I would have thought if he's been there for 20 years, would know bin Laden and have sort of access to that group.
They said the Korangalis are Taliban, all of them, or are there more likely to be supporters of the Taliban than people in other parts of Afghanistan?
They sort of have a funny history. About 150 years ago, the Korangalis came from Nuristan, and they speak a language that is not even understood in the next valley over. They settled in the Korangal Valley. They're not understood even by people who live very close by.
That must make it very difficult for the American forces and the NATO forces, because even if they have been trained to speak one of the local languages, this is a whole other thing.
It's a whole other thing. It's a Pashtun dialect that very few people speak. And they're fierce fighters. And so the Soviets tried to enter the Korangal Valley. They failed. They could not get in there. They fought off the Taliban. The Taliban did not achieve complete control of the Korangal Valley. And then later, they started fighting the Americans with the help of the Taliban. I mean, in Afghanistan, allegiances shift very, very easily. They're very fluid. And so now they're allied with the Taliban. But essentially, they are very violently opposed to any form of control.
Well, I spoke earlier with pollster Craig Charney about how Afghan people feel about what's happening in their country. And according to his poll, they're very upset and concerned about U.S. and NATO attacks on civilians. Is that an issue in the Korangal Valley as well? Or is everybody politicized enough so that you can't really tell who's a civilian and who's a fighter?
I think that is an issue. And in fact, on the operation that I was on with Battle Company in October, there was an incident where we were coming to go to a village where we knew insurgents were grouping. And during the night, Apache helicopters and A-10s were making runs as groups of what they thought were insurgents were dissipating out of the village. And a house was hit. And when we turned up there in the morning, we came across a scene where 5 people had died. Many were wounded. 2 men, 2 young boys, 2 children and a woman. And the villagers were extremely upset about this. Now, I mean, I know from spending time with the Americans that their intel is usually pretty good. Their communications are good. They have good translators. So, that they bombed the house in the belief that insurgents were present. The problem is that insurgents do use, civilians as shields almost. They do go into houses where the civilians are, usually because it's so interbred with their families. So it's a very complicated situation. It's very easy for things to sort of get out of control.
And you point out in the article that there is a certain amount of appreciation for the roads and the schools that the U.S. is building in hopes of capturing hearts and minds.
Yeah, I mean, that's the heart of a counterinsurgency strategy, which is what the U.S. is doing there. Counterinsurgency is not a purely military approach to a country. In fact, counterinsurgency acknowledges that there is no military solution, but what you have to do is deprive the insurgents of a support among the population by sort of wooing the population yourself. And so the American soldiers are drilling wells, they're building roads, that kind of thing, that really is tremendously beneficial to the local population.
My guests are Sebastian Younger and Tim Hetherington. Their article and photo spread is in the January issue of Vanity Fair magazine. They're also filming a documentary for ABC News on this?
Yes, we're carrying video cameras. In addition to our work for Vanity Fair, we're carrying video cameras and shooting a lot of videos. So our footage appeared on Nightline about a month and a half ago, and we're continuing to shoot video for the rest of this year.
Do you just focus on the U.S. soldiers, or were you able to talk to any Karangalis?
We are focusing on the U.S. soldiers. I mean, that's the story. Our story is about what happens to young men or men when where they've come from in the States and where they end up, and psychologically what war does to a young man. That's the focus of our story. There are occasions where we've ended up in local Karangali, you know, with locals and seen that situations. But in some ways, what we're doing is also, it's about America. It's about Americans in America. And certainly for me, it was the first time that I'd spent a significant amount of time with sort of a side of America I'd never seen before. And that was fascinating.
Well, would it be any different for British troops in the area? Because there are British troops in Afghanistan.
Would it be different? I suppose, it's different in the way that I understand what British troops are like, and I don't understand, say, what Middle America's like, and this is my first proper unmediated exposure to Middle America.
So what is daily life like for the men in the 2nd Platoon? They're all men, I'm assuming.
They're all men, yes. Yeah, there are no women in the unit. They're at this very on this very exposed outpost. They were dropped up there in the middle of the night with shovels, basically, and they started digging like crazy so that they'd have some protection against the bullets when dawn came. This was last summer.
So they shoveled out trenches.
Exactly. I mean, these guys are. This is really old time soldiering. They are fighting with shovels and rifles, and they use their shovels to dig holes and they get in them and fight.
And they can't bring in tanks and other machines.
It's too the terrain's too rugged. There's no roads. It's very, very rugged terrain. So we have spent barely any time even in Humvees. Everything is on foot. And the outpost itself, I mean, there's no electricity. There's no running water. There's no heat. There's no cover. It's sandbags and ammunition and MREs. That's basically what they have there.
It's very inaccessible. I mean, even trying to get it up there in a helicopter, it's very difficult. And often, sometimes the helicopters, they're canceled because we come under fire. I remember a time in September when we were trying to get out of the Korongol, and we were with a bunch of soldiers about to leave. And literally, as soon as they see the Korongali or the enemy see a helicopter enter the valley, all hell breaks loose. And, you know, I remember there was a time we were trying to get on the helicopter, and eventually, during that day, a guy was shot dead and shot through the neck as he was trying to get off or on a helicopter. And, that's the environment. It's a very tough environment.
So how do they get their supplies? Helicopters land further down the hill?
Well, they drop them by parachute from planes. Helicopters do come in. They just take fire when they come in. They hire local truck drivers to drive supplies in, but the trucks get shot at. It's tough.
Do you think things would be different if the United States was funneling more of its resources into Afghanistan instead of Iraq?
I mean, in any war, the more men you have, the easier it goes for you.
Do the men talk about that?
Well, we're journalists, so they're a little careful about saying something that they might not want to see in print. And it's not that much of a mystery that if you double the amount of men in the Korongal Valley, things would go a little bit better.
Would we then be able to stop the Taliban from taking over towns as they seem to be able to do every so often?
I'm not a military man, and it's really hard for me to answer that. I think some of the problem, our window into Afghanistan is a very narrow one. It's a 6-mile-long valley. 20% of all the combat in Afghanistan happens in that valley. It's a very intense place, but it's still very small. From my impression is that if there were American troops garrisoned in every town in that valley, the fight would be very different, and there are not enough troops to do that.
What was the Korongal Valley's role during the Soviet-Afghan War in the 1980s? Was it similar to what we're seeing now?
Yeah, I believe it was, and it was used as a transport route. I mean, it's a very strategic place because it's on the route that lies between Pakistan and going to Kabul. So it's the area that you'll take weapons and ammunition through. And if the Korongal Valley is lost, and it's the valley from which the surrounding area can easily be controlled, then the Taliban will be able to bring in weapons and supplies closer to Kabul. I mean, there's already talk that they're on the outskirts of Kabul at night, and I know there has been a recent increase in car bombings, suicide bombings in Kabul. I mean, there was one the other day, and a lot of people died. There was one in suburbs, you know. So, you know, this thing is increasing, and you know, my sense on it is that I feel that it's going to be a tough war to actually win. But nowadays, and from my experience in covering conflicts, often wars aren't won. You fight a war because it creates a hiatus. It creates a break in which you can have political dialogue. And my concern about Afghanistan is that whilst the focus is on Iraq, there isn't significant political dialogue happening. Everybody's sort of just content with the status quo. And the coalition forces haven't made a very clear sort of outline of what to do on poppy eradication or controlling opium or on the Karzai government. And I think that this needs to be addressed.
Is normal life possible in the Kurangali Valley if all of these other things are happening? What did the locals do? Are they farming?
They are farming. The hillsides are very steep, and they've been terraced. These are incredible works that they've done, terracing the fields. And they grow wheat. They dry the wheat on the roofs of their houses. And they cut timber in the upper ridges. And so the Kurangalis are actually fairly affluent, by Afghan standards.
And then they're involved in the smuggling, you say?
And of course, there's smuggling, and there's a whole timber mafia that moves timber out of the Kurangal Valley and sells it in Pakistan. So they're doing pretty well, actually.
Do they see themselves as Pashtun? Because you say that they are a part of the Pashtun, but because they speak a different language,
no, they see themselves as Kurangal.
Yeah. Who were some of the American soldiers you got to know in the second platoon? I mentioned earlier the 27-year-old who you said was like the old man of the platoon, Kevin Rice.
Oh God! Every guy in the platoon you could really talk about for a while. One of them, his father was a labor organizer, and he's absolutely
an anti-war protester.
And an anti-war protester, although he's very, very admiring of his son for joining the military. It's a fun, and he's very supportive of the troops. But he's protested every war the United States has ever been in. Sergeant Rice has been wounded 3 times. He's eligible for a discharge. And he's refusing it. He's determined to go back to the to Restrepo, where his men are, because he's worried about his men. Another guy, Sergeant Hijar, he was advised by everyone in his family not to join the military, and no one could give him a good reason not to. So he's keeping a journal. And what he told us was, if he has children, if he has sons and they want to join the military, he's going to say, look, you can do whatever you want, but first you have to read my journal from when I was in the military, and then you can make your choice.
Because there's a certain disillusionment factor here?
I think he just wants he would want his children to have a completely realistic idea of what they're getting into before they get into it. And I should say that, you know, this is not a draft army. It's a volunteer army. And more than that, a very small fraction of the soldiers in Afghanistan are actually combat soldiers. And the ones who are combat soldiers by choice, and they're very, very proud of it. So this is a very elite role that they're extremely proud of. This is not one of those guys has ever said anything to me that sounded like they felt they were unfortunate in what they were doing.
You mentioned there were no women in the group. There are women who are serving in Iraq. Would Afghanistan be too difficult or more difficult than some other countries to serve in?
There's plenty of women serving in the U.S. military in Afghanistan, just not at these remote fire bases and outposts.
Uh-huh. And is it different for a woman in the American military in Afghanistan than other places because of the varying attitudes about women in Afghanistan?
I didn't get that impression. I think there's many women on the other bases. As I said, it's just in battle company, the 173rd Airborne, in this place there are no women. And
how did this platoon feel about your presence?
We have managed to. They have welcomed us, and that's been an amazing privilege to become very close to them in a certain sort of way. I mean, when we go there, we stay in the barracks with them, and I think that the combat there is so extreme, and that by being present, that they kind of see that you're willing to go through this with them. You know, when Sebastian was talking before about battle company and the sort of extremities of combat, and what, like with Hijar keeping the diary, I mean, he keeps the diary because the psychological pressure there is so extreme. There was an incident during the operation in which we were ambushed and one guy was injured,
And you witness all this.
In fact, I broke my leg, and I managed to, the commanding officer came in with Apaches, and I managed to get out on the helicopter. I was very lucky. But there was combat the day before, when Taliban overran American lines. So yeah, you know, you do witness stuff. But on this occasion, I wasn't there. But as I got out, luckily, and the guys walked back to the firebase, and on the way they were ambushed. And one guy, Brennan, was injured, and his medic Mendoza, the Taliban came and tried to drag the body off. And Mendoza, the only way he came, and basically he attacked them and died in the process to save his friend being dragged off alive. So, you know, this is pretty extreme combat, and the guys, you know, obviously feel that the burden of that.
And are you going back to this somewhere down the line?
I'm going back in January. Tim's still on crutches, but by April, when things sort of pick up there, he'll be healthy. We're going back together in April, and then every couple of months or so until they redeploy in September.
Well, obviously there is the adrenaline rush aspect to this. Otherwise, I might say you're crazy.
It's complicated. I mean, psychologically complicated. It's sometimes very, very frightening. It's less frightening. I found that shooting video makes it less frightening because you have a job to do. But it's also incredibly gratifying to be with these guys.
And there you said that fighting will pick up. There's obviously a seasonal aspect to all of this. By the way, you can read Sebastian Younger's article, Into the Valley of Death, in the January issue of Vanity Fair, with photographs from Tim Hetherington. We have a link to it posted on our show page. We also have a slideshow of Tim's photos that were taken in the Korangali Valley. And I want to thank you so much, both of you, for being on our show today to talk about Afghanistan as part of our underreported series.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, whether you should be concerned about those new smart products like navigation systems and homes that anticipate residents' every need. Also, Sam Keen on his new essay collection about bird watching. Men's figure skater Brian Boitano will stop by, and we explore consciousness on Please Explain. By the way, we have a new listener photo project. Send us a photo of a random object that has special meaning to you, and tell us the story behind the object. You can find out how to submit on our show page at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Scott Goldberg, and Sarah English. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Rory Bernstein, Tess Hartman, and Tanya Wiedeking. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.